All right, the next matter that's here for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus McMorris, court file A180684. As counsel's aware, both sides here have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. As you begin your arguments, feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort, and please identify yourselves for us for the record. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court, my name is Ira Whitlock, counsel. Good morning, and thank you for hearing this matter this morning, Your Honors. Obviously, we have a very important case before the court today, and again, I thank you for your time. I have submitted my brief, Your Honor, and I will obviously try not to recite my brief. The crux of the matter here today, respectfully, is Mr. McMorris, my client, was deprived of fair trial. His substantial rights were affected, and I'm going to ask this court to focus on a main theme of his of the fact that the judge involved herself to a point where she denied Mr. McMorris a fair trial. My main argument is that by not being allowed to present a full case about Mr. McMorris's character and the type of man he was and his relationship with the deceased, it deprived him of his chance to present a complete defense. Now, the court is going to want to focus, and I'm sure I'm going to get questions pretty quickly here about the fact that the judge has discretion to make certain rulings per the rules of evidence. I do understand that, and I respect that. As an officer of the court, I'm not here because I lost. I'm a grown man, and I understand I can't win them all. I made reference to a murder case very similar to Mr. McMorris's case that I won in Ramsey County in 2011. And I know the court isn't going to want me to talk about that. But in that case, the district court allowed a full case to be presented. One of the most heinous crimes that we can conceive of is a infant child who's defenseless being beaten to death and murdered, ultimately, if you believe the state's case. But there have been serious cases here, even in the state of Minnesota, where the last person with the child is the one who's charged. And Ms. Caldwell's case, and I won't mention names, I know we're doing a public record here, and I can't keep up with data practices and all of the rules, but in that Ramsey County case, she was acquitted of all counts. My theme in that case was the good mom, because the state said she was a terrible mom.
But you did, in this case, get in some of that evidence, didn't you?
Only some, Your Honor.
Right, and you got expert testimony to support your theme that the fact that your client was the last person with the child doesn't mean that your client caused the child's death. So, I mean, at some point, it's where do you draw the line as the district court judge? And what is your strongest argument that the district court abused its discretion and where it drew the line in terms of how much of that character evidence and how much of the defense evidence should get in? Where is that line crossed?
That line is crossed when you have a young man's life on the line, and I know I don't come here to scare anybody about
this. Well, but I think what Judge Bjorkman's getting at, Mr. Whitlock, is the problem that I had in evaluating your arguments, in that you claim evidentiary errors by the trial court. But I'm not sure there's one citation in your brief to any point of the record of any specific errors that you claim the trial court made. So it makes it very difficult to evaluate your arguments.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the court should evaluate this judge's actions as a whole. In terms of her Honor's question, what we have to focus on is that this judge is interpreting her version. She's giving her interpretation of the rule. And so whether character evidence can be allowed or not. And they're conflicting terms, but her interpretation of the rule doesn't supersede my client's constitutional right.
And so is it because, because there were people that testified that your client was a good person, that he was a patient father, and you wanted to get, I think, more specific examples. You wanted these defense witnesses to be, and I think there were 9 of them, to be able to stand up and say, on this particular date, this is what I saw, as opposed to general testimony. Is that sort of where the line, where the district court abused its discretion and not letting those details in?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. So when you talk about an abuse of discretion, for instance, the state has unlimited resources. Her Honor would not even pay for a recut of the slides so that my expert could evaluate those slides. The family had to come out of its pocket for $5,000. Yet the state brings 5 experts in, which was overkill. But of course, with my skill set, I still think I can talk with the best of them and I will cross-examine vigorously. But at the end of the day, one simple example is Her Honor did not allow in an anatomical chart that my expert had prepared and she wanted to discuss just to show the makeup of a body, a child's body, because the anatomical chart was of an adolescent instead of a toddler, the judge ruled that it couldn't come in. Now, this is after the state has had 5 experts and, obviously did everything it could to discredit my one expert, and they wouldn't even give my expert all of the resources she needed. To do the best competent job. So when you talk about those types of restrictions, it interferes with my ability to present a complete defense. It interfered with Dr. Alphoven's ability to present her full case. So that threw a stumbling block in it. Yes, she can just describe a kid's body, but being able to show the jurors where a spleen is, where the liver is in relation to possible broken ribs, which she was arguing, was just... it threw her off. It threw off the defense, and it was prejudicial. In another situation, the judge allows the rebuttal evidence of Dr. Baker, who didn't perform the autopsy, but he comes in with a Apple cell phone, reviews the slide, and calls Dr. Alphoven a crackpot in front of the jury and saying she doesn't know what she's talking about. So what I'm going to ask this body to focus on is Mr. McMorris's fundamental rights to a fair trial. Whatever mistakes I might have made, and I do call myself, I do make a claim that I was ineffective, but my ability to be effective was as a result of the judge making rulings to help the state. I don't know why judges feel like they need to help the state. The state wins 90% of its cases in some counties and jurisdictions. They don't need to help the state. The judge should have allowed me to pursue character evidence to the nth degree to be able to say not only that Mr. McMorris was a good father and a good man, but nonviolent, and how he interacted with the deceased.
But doesn't the rules of evidence specifically prohibit that, Mr. Whitlock?
No,
you're
it doesn't.
You're the one that raised the issue of opinions on character and put those character traits into controversy. I thought the rules were pretty clear that you can give general opinions, but specific instances of conduct are not admissible.
So. It's not admissible, and this is obviously we do this for a living, Your Honor. I mean no disrespect, but it's not that clear, Your Honor. If the character of accused is brought up, evidence of a pertinent trait of character offered by an accused or by the prosecution should be allowed to rebut a claim that is opposite. So if the state is going to bring in 5 experts, one of which who said she was 100% sure this couldn't have happened at the daycare. Now, she isn't God. She wasn't there. But she became a mercenary. To tell the jury as an expert that you're 100% sure this couldn't have happened at the daycare, although I had classic examples of this daycare being derelict in its duties, judge wouldn't even allow me to use that evidence to counter her or cross-examine her, to contradict her. She said, there are too many people at this type of facility for this kind of thing to happen. Yet a child was lost for 2 hours. One walked out into the parking lot, could have walked into the street and gotten hit by a car. I couldn't use those examples to make the jury understand that there is a possibility this happened at the daycare. And the daycare was cited for not properly reporting these injuries. But of course they tried to cover themselves once this baby died because they knew there was going to be a case, and they knew they were possibly going to be prime suspects. Had I been able to delve into that more, maybe we could have come up with a suspect, a particular worker at the KinderCare who was abusive and had a history. But we never got there because the judge didn't allow it. The fundamental fairness of him being able to complete a complete defense, when you evaluate the character evidence, like the judge in Ramsey County did, and said, if they're going to claim this person, as my old professor Marino used to say, is the mad bombist rapist killer, and as the worst person walking the planet, he should be able to stand up and say, I'm not that. Give you an example, with all due respect. Off the topic here, I haven't cited statute 63420, I believe it is, Minnesota statute. It allows, in domestic abuse cases, it allows a victim of domestic abuse, with all due respect to that being serious, she's not the defendant in a trial facing a capital crime. I know we don't have capital murder here, you know, the death penalty here, but this is as bad as it gets in our system. It wasn't a first degree either, so I acknowledge that. But if a person in a domestic abuse case has the right to present the history of the relationship in front of the jury so that it doesn't look like he or she is just claiming he beat me up or she beat me up one time, then why shouldn't a defendant be able to say, not only did I not murder this child, let me show you pictures of me with her. Let me show you what our relationship was really like. Let me show you that the state's theme of the case, theory of the case, as the court may or may not know, was that my client found out he wasn't the father and beat the baby to death. When I was able to debunk that by calling Ramsey County officials who said he hadn't even gotten the results prior to her death, and that they had just gotten them the day before, and then they have a 5 or 6 day process that they go through before it's even sent to the mother and father in terms of as relates to who's the paternity, just say it that way. And so when that theory got debunked, they decided to hire more experts to just come in and pile on. This is an innocent man here, and this court, despite any of my shortcomings, despite not being able to convince Dr. Oppoven that because the state had 5 experts, it would have been pertinent for her to tell me who evaluated her case and who confirmed her results. This expert might have been willing to come in had I had his or her name. I could have subpoenaed them, and we could have tried to seek more funding so that that person could have came in and supported her theme.
Mr. Whitlock, I wanted to, it seems to me, the great focus of your appeal is the district court's refusal to admit the instances of, I don't know what the word is, neglect at the daycare. I mean, would that, and you believe that had you been able to sort of get that in, then your client's right to present a full defense would have been vindicated. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, almost, Your Honor. That's certainly one of the main parts of my argument. I do think her not allowing just photos and basic discussions about my client's interaction with this baby. I know you weren't there live, but you have the transcript. They showed the video multiple times of this baby bouncing around in her stroller. They never wanted to let the jury hear that he treated her with kind hands.
And I understand that. But in the district court's analysis of why it didn't allow the two instances, incidents, she indicated that the two incidents that do not directly involve or relate to the child are not relevant to this matter. It's unclear that the teachers involved in those incidents were teachers in the child's room at the time she was attending daycare. Additionally, the two incidents are separated by more than 2 years. 3 instances simply isn't enough to indicate the daycare center as a whole failed to supervise the children in attendance there. Moreover, the child was an infant in the infant room, you know, not in the room where these instances occurred. Given that the violation of these two incidents, which are very different from the violation that involved the child, and again, different ages. So, and then she sort of cites to, and even if relevant, which she seems to think it was not, the evidence may be excluded because probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice and the citation of the rest of the rule. Now, if that's the record before the court and before us, could you articulate as to why you believe it's clear that the judge abused its discretion in not admitting that evidence?
Because the court allowed an expert witness who was not qualified to say she was 100% sure that this could happened at the daycare.
I'm not talking about the expert now. I'm talking about this. There are several issues on appeal. One of them is the exclusion of this evidence.
Yes.
So my concern, well, my question is, you know, that looks like a balancing test analysis to me. And what I'm trying to find out is, where did the court, in announcing that analysis, abuse its discretion?
It is a cumulative argument that where she sees the evidence coming in and she's evaluating that this young man, one, was restricted in the expert he could hire, wouldn't pay for the slides for her to be able to do the job she needed to do. The state had five experts. And so when you're evaluating her interpretation of the statute, first of all, to say it was not relevant is just wrong. This interferes with the structural procedure process in this case. I mean, just to deny my client the opportunity to say, first of all, you can't be 100% sure this didn't happen at the daycare. And let me explain to the jurors, even if this didn't happen in the toddler room, this entire facility is what she talked about, that it were too many people at this facility for these types of things to happen. This baby could have been abused in many places. In the Ramsey County case that I discussed, I was able to ferret out evidence that my client's brother punched the baby with a cast on the day before at 6 p.m. But because she found the baby whimpering at 5 a.m., they charged her and her boyfriend. She said it wasn't her boyfriend, but this guy she was dating and having sexual relations with. So to stifle the defense and not allow me to even attack incredible arguments allowed this mercenary expert to persuade the jury that they were right and I was wrong. And I did try to use the argument that more is not always better, that me having one expert was sufficient. I understand my time is running, and I'll accept a rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Whitlock. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jean Burdorf. I represent respondent, state of Minnesota. The argument that you just heard is an argument that the defense, the right to present a defense, is basically unlimited and that you don't have to follow court rules. In each of the complained of instances, you will see in the transcript that the district court looked at the rules, looked at the language of the rules, and followed those rules. For example, with character evidence, the district court judge here allowed in 9 witnesses to testify about opinion and reputation for good parenting, being a good person, and nonviolence. Those are all the pertinent character traits in this particular case. What the district court did not allow, and this goes to your question, Judge Bjorkman, is specific instances of conduct that were designed to demonstrate good character. That is exactly what the Minnesota Rule of Evidence 405A prohibits. Just it's straight analysis according to the rules. So the district court not only didn't err, but you couldn't surely show an abuse of discretion. The same is true with regard to the other evidence that the district court kept out, which is the other instances at the KinderCare. Judge Connolly read that analysis. She made the appropriate relevance analysis. It is reverse Spriegel evidence, which requires a marked similarity between those instances that were excluded and what happened in this particular case or what was alleged to have happened in this particular case. And then the district court judge did the 403 balancing exactly as the rules and case law require. That also was not an abuse of discretion. The remainder of the argument, some of the arguments Mr. Whitlock made aren't even contained in the brief, and I have absolutely no ability on the fly to respond to those, so I won't. The remaining arguments I think are adequately documented in my brief with supporting case law and citations to the record, and I would ask this court to rely on my brief in this matter for the remaining issues.
I get a sense that kind of the overall theme from the appellant is that just this playing field was not level and in fact seemed to be stacked in favor of the party that has the burden of proof. Whether it's providing experts access to information or excluding evidence, how do you respond to the overall suggestion that the way this trial was conducted deprived Mr. McMorris of his right to present complete defense and to have a fair trial?
I guess my global response is this. Fairness in a criminal trial doesn't mean a level playing field. This isn't a baseball game where everyone comes to the field on a given day and has an equal chance of winning. That is not the design of our criminal justice system. The prosecution does hold the burden of proof. We are required to bring a person to trial to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Ethically, that is our duty. So we should have a mountain of evidence, relevant evidence that is going to be admitted at a trial in order to validly obtain a conviction. So the idea that we had five experts, there's no allegation those experts were cumulative. They were not. Each expert that the state called had something of value to add. The fact that there were five doesn't suggest anything improper or unfairly prejudicial. And it is, in fact, the evidence that the state thought was necessary to meet its great burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I guess globally, that is my response. With regard to this specific trial, I did put some transcript citations. One of the arguments is this is a case of judicial bias. I did invite the court to read the Mems case. I don't think disfavorable or unfavorable rulings are sufficient to show that a judge structurally acted with bias against a defendant. That was the claim in Mems, a case I handled. That was rejected. There's a number of transcript citations in my brief. In the section where I address Mems, I'm not going to read them to you here. But each of those transcript citations, what you will see is an argument made or an objection made. Some of those rulings went in the state's favor, according to law. Some of those rulings went in the defendant's favor. And I think just as you look at the record as a whole, what you see is a district court judge who is very, very deliberate, all of the time asking for authority to support positions, and then making rulings that were consistent with the rules of evidence and the rules of criminal procedure, and then documenting and making a very, very good and complete record of each ruling she made. So some are for, some are against. And I just don't think that this is a situation where we count numbers. The district court judge is required to follow the law. And if the judge followed the law, even if every single ruling went in favor of the state, that wouldn't necessarily be indicative of judicial bias. So I think that claim, just there is absolutely no support in the record based on the district court judge's evidentiary rulings in this case to find that there was some kind of structural unfairness. Okay, in the absence of other questions, as I indicated, I would rest on the arguments, citations, and case law that I have cited in my brief. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Burdorf. Rebuttal, Mr. Whitlock?
Thank you.
Your Honors, again, as we talked about the crux of the matter here, the right of a defendant to be able to present his version of the facts and an opportunity to tell the true story of his relationship with the deceased was deprived, and it deprived him of his fundamental right to a fair trial. When we talk about the rules of evidence, if we're talking about specific instances of conduct, which is what the state is claiming, that my client all of a sudden became enraged. Their debunked theory that he found out that he wasn't the father, they had to leave by the wayside because I had evidence directly contradicting it. But if they want to make specific instances of conduct that he is the mad bombist rapist killer, the rules say in a case in which character or trait of character of a person is an essential element of a charge, claim, or defense, proof may also be made of specific instances of that person's conduct. The rule also allows cross-examination of that person about specific instances of conduct. So how should an individual with a constitutional right to a fair trial and to present a defense not be able to mention his relationship with the child and go into full character? They called the man a killer. They said he went into a rage and beat this baby to a pulp and didn't then call 911 in a timely manner so as to allow her to expire. So he should absolutely be able to have evidence presented. The mother of the deceased, the grandmother of the deceased, got up, and although the judge had ruled that she couldn't say some of the things she said, she blurted out some things. But I couldn't, as an officer of the court, elicit those things, because then I would be in this court or some other for a different reason, for, you know, improper conduct as an attorney. So I had to follow the rules. I wanted to attack the expert who said she was 100% sure and acted as if she was God. I wanted to do more to say, what about these cases at the daycare? But I was deprived of doing that. This judge showed clear bias, and the Supreme Court makes it clear that the Minnesota Supreme Court says has warned judges that they should avoid the appearance of impropriety and should not act so as to give even a reason for jurors or anyone else in that courtroom to believe that she was biased. Counsel throws out the fact that the defense had some minor rulings in its favor. I think when this court and its inherent authority looks at all of the evidence and looks at the transcript in this case, you'll determine that Mr. McMorris was prejudiced by the judge's actions. She did not need to help the state. They had five experts and a strong case. When Dr. Oppoven testified, whether she worked for St. Louis County or when she otherwise testifies for the prosecution, she's great. When she testifies for the defense, she's a monster. Dr. Oppoven attempted to back out of the case just days before the trial. I was with her, and I don't like to talk professionally about the fact that she cried when I was at her office meeting, because I had to continue to disclose to her things that the state was sending to me that they were going to use to cross-examine her. The intimidation of Dr. Oppoven, if you evaluate this one fact, and some of it is not in the trial court record in the sense that it was ex parte, but that...
How can we even consider it?
Because I did make an ultimate record about the fact that she was depriving my client of
the affidavits you filed after the fact.
Not just in those affidavits.
Because they weren't part of the trial record either.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But either one of counsel's arguments is that this wasn't argued before the trial court, but I also have an obligation to raise every possible issue here. If I don't display that there was fundamental, that things were not fair, if I don't explain that Naja, the mother of the deceased, has been intimidated, even to the point of them wanting to strip Mr. McMorris of his rights to his new son, even though he hasn't been deemed the father and a declaration of parentage hasn't been filed. That intimidation continues. Again, Dr. Thomas and Dr. Oppoven both testified that in previous cases here in the state of Minnesota that they had been intimidated not to testify for the defense. So all I can do is argue the evidence that's before me and present to this court so that you can look at the overall entire circumstances and evaluate whether or not you believe Mr. McMorris received a fair trial. I think the evidence shows that he didn't receive a fair trial. He should have been able to pursue aggressively more evidence to show his good character, that he was actually a good father, that he had accepted this child as his own. And so it's hard to prove a negative. But at the end of the day, the record shows that this court deprived Mr. McMorris of a fair trial. Her role in that means he should automatically get this court to reverse the matter and get a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitlock. The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a decision within 90 days. Thank you.